Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Ramsey Paul. Nice to have you back
Robert,
on.
How are you doing? Hey, it's good to be back. It's been a while.
So you were recently one of, basically you were like the keynote speaker at Amren.
I'm going to call myself a keynote. I think Jared's a keynote. I spoke at the banquet, though. After everyone's been drinking, Jared figures that's the best place to put me now. You know, people have some drinks in them. They can get through my speech. So, yeah, that's where I speak. You got to come to Amren.
I'm in California, but I'll have to make the next one.
Yeah, most people are really nice there. I mean, I've never met anyone I didn't like there. They're a good crowd, but yeah, I'm a little bit different type of speaker than most. So I applaud Jared to take the risk of putting someone like me up there. So because everyone else is like really smart and educated, and they wrote all these books, and you know, I just drink some beer and make videos. So yeah, but I do my thing, and people seem to like it. So I enjoy it. I love to meet the people that watch my videos. So it's something every year I really look forward to.
I saw you did that video, Amren, Faces of Evil, Amren 2015, Faces of Evil.
Yeah, that was, I just want to give people the glimpse of the evil people that it, it's so funny because all the stereotypes about Amren, but Amren is more, I think, diverse than the protesters. In fact, I know that's the case. I mean, there's every type of ethnicity you can imagine attends Amren, and so it's just because it's not a club or anything anyone can attend. You just have to pay your fee and you can listen to speakers. So it's more of just I would call a traditional conservative gathering. The only spin is that Amren doesn't hate white people, and we've gone so far to the left now. Unless you hate white people, that makes you evil. So that's where it is right now. But Amren doesn't hate white people, and they don't really hate anyone. So everyone's welcome.
And with your speech, I see you did that thing, the shy nationalist. So you actually, a lot of people don't know this about you. They see you as sort of, I guess some people see you as like a stand-up comedian. But you've actually had a lot of... stage fright and fear of public speaking in the past, or you still do?
Oh, yeah. I am a shy person. And as I said in that video, a lot of actors, I saw Johnny Depp, and he was really quite sincere. I'm not comparing myself to him. I wish I was like him, all his money and his looks. But even him, he says he's naturally shy. So that's common with actors and so forth is, you know, you like to perform, you like the craft, but you don't necessarily, you know, you're not like a party guy or life of the party. I'm not that at all. I mean, I like conversations. I think I can act okay with people. And, you know, to me, a perfect thing is a couple people at dinner, you know, just conversation that way. But I'm not a big party guy. I never have been.
Yeah, I think I remember someone said that you reminded them of that actor from the British actor from the HBO show Hello Ladies, which I think is now off the air.
Yeah, I saw that guy. I forgot the guy's name, but yeah, I guess I do kind of look like him, which I guess is a compliment because he's younger than me, but yeah.
Oh, Stephen Merchant.
Yeah, Stephen Merchant. Yeah, we kind of do look alike, I guess. I don't know. So I'm sure Stephen Merchant doesn't like that, but yeah, that's okay.
And you also posted that video. Oh, you posted the video. Was it a TED Talk by Susan Cain, The Power of Introverts?
Yeah, it was an interesting talk. Sometimes TED has some interesting subjects, and that was it got a lot of views because I think a lot of people can relate to that. I think about like a third of the people are considered like introverts, and it doesn't mean you're shy or you can't get along with people. It just means you prefer, you know, low stimulation and you like to be alone when you think, and that's how I work. And I used to be a programmer, and when I did that sort of thing, I just want to be by myself and figure out, you know, how to write some code. So I don't really like to work with teams or anything. I just like to do my own thing, which kind of goes with my camera making or my video making. It's something I just do on my own. I'm not beholden to anyone, so I enjoy that. It's a lot of fun.
you'd much rather do those videos on your own than go out and do stand-up comedy on a regular basis.
Yeah. It's so funny because I don't consider myself a comedian. I'm just a guy. And when I was a kid growing up or a teenager, I hanged out with guys a lot funnier than me, like Rob. He watches my videos. Al, David, he's dead now. But I mean, we'd just get together and we'd be drinking. And, you know, guy, I don't know how guys do it now, but we'd just, you know, making jokes and everything. It was just something we did. So that's just kind of what I do. I don't consider myself really a comedian per se. I mean, I do jokes, but it's not. I mostly just comment on culture Marxism and make fun of it, mock it. Because it's a nice, easy target out there because they really mock themselves. They're just so outrageous and so silly. It's just so fun. And see, the mainstream media is usually scared to make fun of them because they don't be politically incorrect. So that opens up, I mean, the whole area where people like me can get into it and fill that niche.
Yeah, they make your job so easy because it's hard to come up with funny stuff just out of nowhere, but they give you the material, so you don't need to make it up.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And you know, like I said, someone like Jon Stewart, I mean, he has a whole team of writers, but they pretty much just have to focus on the right. There's so many taboos they really can't go into. So that leaves it open to us on the right. We can have a lot of fun out there because very few, I mean, South Park to a degree did some politically incorrect things. But in general, entertainers and comedians are scared to death of making fun of certain protected groups for obvious reasons, right? Because they want to further their career. But if you're like me and you don't really give a damn, then you can just, you know, do what you want and have fun. What a lot of people are thinking, you can just put to words. So that's kind of what I do.
So the theme of your speech is titled The Red Pill. And The Red Pill, though, originally that was obviously, most people have seen the film The Matrix, so it's from
right.
That film.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to ask you, do you think that term, The Red Pill, do you think it's getting a little, starting to get like too cliche?
Yeah, it's become more mainstream. It's been banting around a bit, but on the internet, it's been around for quite a few years, and it really started out more on the men's mansphere, I guess they call it. You know, it kind of came up with it, which means you look at women how they really are, not how Hollywood or Disney tries to portray women, and which isn't bad or good. It's just seeing how things really are, and that's where they got the term red pill, meaning it's like you take a pill and you see things how they really are instead of the way you're trying to imagine them to be. So I expanded that concept because I think that applies more than just to sexual relations. It applies to, you know, our whole society, how you look at things, like equality. Is everyone really equal? Now, there's no evidence for that. So that's kind of a red pill thought. So I talked about the red pill, and really my speech wasn't anything about feminism or race. It's just more about problems of globalization and of what's called scale.
Oh, and then you did start off with I think it got like more serious towards the end, but you started off with two jokes. So one of them was here's your first joke. Your first joke was to get over stage fright. You pictured everyone naked, but that really didn't work out at your first job.
Yeah, because I was an elementary school teacher. Yeah. Yeah, I remember that one, yeah. So, yeah, I guess I told a few jokes in there. I haven't watched the video. Is it good? I haven't watched it. I'll have to do that sometime. I was just going to say, if people want to see the video, Amran has it on their site, Amran on YouTube, so that's where it is.
Oh, your other joke about the Neolithic porn, two girls, one club.
Yeah. And people that laugh at it, I said, hey, if you understand that joke, shame on you, right? I mean, because good people would not understand that joke. So, and the sad thing is, I think most people understood the joke. See, that's what I mean. I'm not really, I think Amran's never, you know, really had someone like me there before because everyone else is so much more professional and educated.
I don't know if Jared Taylor gets that joke.
I hope not. I would hope he wouldn't. I'd be really disappointed if he got that joke, and I hope no one told him. So, yeah.
But
so,
I mean,
yeah,
I've never So I've never seen the actual video, but I mean, I know about it because it's so ingrained in popular culture. Like there's a show on Comedy Central. Amy Schumer did like a parody of it.
Yeah, it's a popular meme, and I've never seen the video either. I have no interest in it. But
you're not gonna do a video parodying it.
I post some pretty wild videos though. I did that video where I was about that transvestite boy or whatever who had blood out of my mouth. So that was pretty hardcore. I was kind of pushing it there. I probably went beyond good taste in that video, but hey, that's what I got to do sometimes. I like to stretch the audience. If I was on the left, that'd be considered edgy and provocative, right? So if you're on the right, that's considered hateful. So
the thing is, the left, I mean, they used to be the left used to present themselves as the ones who were pushing the barriers. I mean, going back to like Lenny Bruce in the 60s when he got in trouble with obscenity laws. But now, I mean, now people on the left, they sound like the equivalent of like the church lady who is like telling people what they can and can't say.
Oh yeah, they're really neo-Puritans, and somewhat literally, that's kind of where the philosophy came from. But yeah, some of the people on the left, I admire them. I always liked George Carlin because he started out that way, but as he got older, he became, in many ways, he attacked a lot of politically correct things. So he was pretty independent. I liked his work. He was a great stand-up. That guy had a great memory and mind, and he was able to do great things with wordplay. But you're right, most of the left, they're now... They still want to be edgy, but they do something that's edgy that everyone agrees with and won't get them in trouble, right? It's, you know, for example, Madonna, she could, you know, spit on a Christian cross, edgy man, but, you know, she knows she's not going to get in trouble, but in no way would she ever try to offend the Muslims, right? So they understand
that.
Well,
Bill Maher tells the ethnic jokes every now and then.
Yeah, there's some that will. There's some that are pretty, they don't shy away from either side, but that's pretty rare. Mostly, if they're going to do something that's pushing the bounds, they don't have to worry about, you know, you don't ever have to worry about offending white people or men or heterosexuals. That's fair game. You can advocate killing them and you're not going to get in trouble. But any of the other groups, you got to be a little bit more careful with, which is the advantage of humor, because you can kind of get around a few things by how you phrase things, and it makes it a little more fun that way too.
So basically, what your speech was mostly about is this scale theory, and
right.
I mean, I'm familiar with the overall concept, but when I first heard that term, is someone wrote an article. The original article about scale was. It was in response to that pilot in Germany. I think that's where I first read about it.
Yeah, there's a forum I like to read my posting career, and they had a big discussion about it.
Oh, yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, and scale is just how we're, the complexity is greater than we humans can deal with. And because if you think about it, and I just happened just the past couple of days been doing some genealogy in my family. My grandmother traced them back, actually back to they were in this country before the Revolutionary War, but most of them were in Indiana. And it was interesting, the people, they would be born in a small town and like 90 years later die in the same town. And if you think about it, back then, they'd go their whole lives and they would probably never see another race, and everyone they knew spoke English, and everyone they knew was Christian, maybe a different denomination. And not only they spoke English, they had the same accent, and everything was very local. You grow up in a town, your parents still live there, your grandparents live there, you know, you marry a girl that you probably went to school with, you know their family, they've known your family. That is not just in America, that's how it was for almost all of civilization around the world. I mean, there's a few exceptions. You know, Marco Polo went everywhere, but most people, they just stayed in a certain area. And there's a question is, as animals, which humans are, can we have to try to get all this additional complexity? Where now, let's say if you're an English person in London, the majority of people aren't even English in London, and you have Muslims, and you have all these gay rights, and you have all these different things, and people are becoming very alienated. And I think that's why we're seeing all these social pathologies, because in the rat experiment they did in the 60s, Calhoun did, he showed that when you have these conditions, the rats, they just went crazy, and they started to have pathological behavior that we're seeing now in humans. So I think there's a lot to that.
So you asked a question in regards to the rat experiment. Is population density inherently a problem? And you don't entirely agree with it. You say it depends the situation. So it can work only under certain conditions. If a society is a homogenous and they have the right culture, it can work. It can
work. And there was an example in the Neolithic times. There was some settlement. I forget where it was. But it was packed, the density, because even though there wasn't many people in the world, it's not like humans just spread out everywhere. They lived together in tight communities and very dense communities. And, you know, even 100 years ago, people in London lived in very dense communities. So that doesn't really seem to have a problem with humans, because unlike rats, we have more of a conceptual space, it's called. We can think outside, you know, the greater terms. And so a lot of cities like Singapore and everything, they're pretty healthy, even though they're very dense. So it's not really so much a density. It's just when the conceptual space gets too complicated because of diversity and this, and you're trying to, like I did use an example, one of our greatest things is we need to celebrate the Muslims, bring Muslims in. And also one of the greatest things we got to do is celebrate transgender and gays and homosexual marriage. But it's not compatible. The Muslims want to throw them off buildings. So, and you know, it's just all these contradictions, and these people, they're just becoming alienated because we humans, we're kind of like dogs. Dogs are pack animals. If you chain a dog outside and never give it attention and it's alone, it goes crazy. And we humans, we need to be with people like ourselves. That's how we're our biological units. We need that. Otherwise, we go crazy and we get weird behaviors.
So in the rat experiment, what happens with the rats is they either become hyper-aggressive or they just withdraw.
Yeah, a lot of the male rats, either they became super-aggressive and violent, and a lot of the male rats, they became like, they started to change gender roles and they became more effeminate. I don't know how they tell that with a rat. I have no idea. I guess somehow you could tell that. And this was in a situation where resources weren't limited. I mean, they had plenty of food. There was no natural predators. So it wasn't like they run out of food because of the population. It just eventually got so dense that the colony collapsed on itself, and they had all these pathological behaviors that went from generation to generation until eventually destroyed the whole colony.
Yeah, so this experiment, how long over time did this take place, the rats? Over generations?
I don't know. It's probably a couple of years. He had a lot of acreage they put it on because there's a lot of rats, like 5,000 rats when they kept breeding. I forget the details exactly how long they did the experiment. And that was mostly because they did experiments before then about, you know, what happens when you run out of resources, because that was a big issue in the 70s, you know, overpopulation in the world. Everyone would be dead by the year 2000 because we'd run out of food. Little did they know everyone would be really fat and obese because of cheap food by now. But so things can change. But that was a big thing then, was overpopulation. But now the thing is not so much overpopulation's concern, I think, is that diversity is creating complications that, like I said, we've never had this in the history of mankind. 99% of the people have always lived in communities of people just like themselves, pretty much the same race, the same religion, the same language. And I think as an animal, that's how we're meant to be. We're not an animal that adapts to diversity well without pathological issues. And I think that's why we're seeing all these weird things, right? People that, you know, I'm born in the wrong body, and now you see these people, I'm not only born in the wrong body, I'm not even human, I'm a wolf trapped in a man's body. And a lot of these people are serious, so it's like really pathological, insane behavior that you just didn't see before.
And then you also, you mentioned that book by Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone.
Yeah, and that kind of talked on the same type of themes of the more diversity you have, the less interaction you have, people become more isolated, they become withdrawn. And again, that's not healthy because we're not isolated animals. Even as introverts, we like our times of isolation, but we still need people and companionship and friends and family. That's how we are as a species.
And then that leads to that by itself leads to a lot of problems, psychological problems, and different types of behavior.
Yeah. I mean, we're meant to be with a group, and also because a group can pass down the wisdom and when you have mothers and fathers, and you know, everyone knows each other, so you're accountable. You don't have this wild behavior that people think they can get away with now. And so, you know, when everyone knew each other's families and so forth, it kind of curbed a lot of pathological behavior.
And then in your speech, you talk about the managerial class and managerialism.
Yeah, and that's the problem now. We have, I think, we're becoming now this whole almost like a one world government. And I don't want to use that in a conspiratorial sense, but it's almost like they want to see it as like you have these big managers of corporations, the top executives. They don't see themselves as Americans or British. They see themselves as cosmopolitan. And so they get where the best, cheapest resources are. And it doesn't matter, for example, like for Hertz America, even if they're America, because they don't give a damn about America. They think of themselves as a higher elite, like in charge of this global plantation. And so we got this elite class. We got this weird hybrid. This capitalism, this kind of crony capitalism, because they're all tied into the government. In fact, a lot of the government workers, the government leaders, they go into the business on board, on the various corporate boards, and they're all tied into each other. They have this whole elite class, kind of like the George Soros and all these billionaires that are really controlling everything, and there's not very much representation at a low level, because the more global you get, the less free we become as people, because we don't have self-determination. That's why small countries are bigger than large countries, because you have more control of your own destiny. The United States was ideally, originally, we don't have a constitution anymore, but the name, our name of the country was not United States, it was United States. We had all these states that were, in a sense, independent. So if the people of Alabama didn't want gay marriage, Washington, D.C. couldn't force them on them, because that was their state. They could decide. And we've gone away from that now. We're going higher and higher centralization. And now it's becoming almost a global managerial class, and the rest of the people are becoming peasants on their plantation.
Yeah, and you talk about the cubicle farms, they dehumanize people.
Yes. Yeah, there is. And if you've ever been in a corporation, they call people resources, and they look at people as just disposable things to make a profit, and that's all important for them is growth, 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 profit, profit, profit. But they never ask, really to what ends, why, what's going to happen. I mean, you can't grow forever because of just the mathematics of it. But all they care about is a short term, because that's what their bonuses are based on, the short term profitability, even if it will, destroy a company. I've known major corporations that have been destroyed because they get a new CEO and he cuts research and development, even though that will destroy the company, but in the short term, he can show a profit, so the stock price will go up, and he makes, a $50 million bonus. He's like, well, what the hell do I care? So there's this very short-term focus that destroys the nations and destroys the people, and it's very dehumanizing. So we're seeing this, I think, on a global level.
So you talk about different solutions. Well, first I want to ask you is, was your speech the only one at Ameren that touches upon economics?
I don't remember, to be honest. I think so. There have been speeches at Ameren previously that were economic-based. I remember a couple years ago they had a professor talked about outsourcing and how that's bad for the economy. So it has been talked about. So I can't remember off the top of my head if any other speech had to do with economics, although mine wasn't so much economics, it was more of a philosophy. But, yeah, I did touch on that because the globalization, I travel a lot and I see that everywhere of what's happening.
I remember, the last show we did about a year to a year and a half ago was about economics, and you were mentioning that you used to be more of a libertarian, but that your views have changed in economics.
Yeah, I'm more of now that the trouble with the libertarianism is that it never solves the question of what happens when you no longer need people, because they don't need to sell their labor because you can have machines replace them or whatever, and we're starting to get to that point. And the libertarian really doesn't have an answer to that other than that, well, there'll be other jobs. Well, maybe, but not as many. So what do the people do that can't work? Are they, you know, I guess a libertarian solution as well, just let them starve to death and die. And that's not going to happen. That's not realistic. So I don't think that's a realistic in the real world how things can work. And I would think, I mean, just think about this as a thought experiment. If we did literally have robots that could do all jobs, that should be paradise, right? No one should have to work. You should be able to do whatever you want. So we somehow need to incorporate that idea of not of providing for people, and especially as wealth is created a lot more cheaper now because of machinery and robotics and so forth.
And what you say is capitalism by itself is inherently bad, but it needs controls and limitations on it. You can't have unfettered capitalism.
Correct. And we don't, by the way, have unfettered capitalism. We have kind of a crony capitalism where it's tied into the government.
Someone described managerialism as like combining the absolute worst aspects of both capitalism and communism.
Yeah, and I've talked to people who lived under communism and capitalism, and in some ways they just called it, you know, the two sides of the same coin, and there's some truth to that. And yeah, but right now we have a form of capitalism that rich people, they buy the politicians, and they put in laws to try to have barriers for competition and so forth. Because most big corporations, they don't mind these laws because they can pay it, and it just prevents competition from coming in. So. And then, you know, the politicians are rewarded by money, and they're rewarded, you know, after they get out of office, they get some cushy job doing nothing as a reward. It's a bribe, but they don't call it a bribe. That's what it is. So that's the way the system works. Well, that's why, like, you know, Baker, you know, that guy in the Reagan administration, he was, you have these managerial classes, not, they're not even Republicans or Democrats. Sometimes they serve both administrations, Republicans and Democrats. And then they sit on as boards of all these corporations. Boards, they have no idea what the industry is about. They have no experience in that industry. Why are they on the board and getting that huge salary for doing nothing? Because that's the way they're bribed. That's how modern bribes work. You know, they don't give a suitcase full of money. They say, hey, you know, we really appreciate your help here. And if, once you get out of your position here, we'd love to have you on our team. No, you don't have to do much. Just, you know, we'll give you a six-figure salary just to do some consulting. That's the modern way how they bribe, by the way, and it's done all the time.
So you go into some solutions, and one of the solutions is smaller nations. So let's say a nation like the United States that ideally should be broken up into a bunch of smaller nations. And I remember, didn't you do your last Ameren speech, I think, wasn't it like America in the year 2035?
Mine was on the Dark Enlightenment, my last one.
You did talk about that.
Yeah, but we do need to break apart because of what I was saying with scale, because we're out of scale. And we need to have nations that are more homogeneous, because that's how naturally it is. And this, I don't mean 100% homogeneous, but just where you have the same cultures and everything, it keeps things happier. People are happier. There's less pathology. So I'm anti-diversity. Diversity is one of the worst things that you can have as for humans. It's a cancer with humans. I think for all races, it creates issues. And it's more than race, but it's good to have separate ethnicities, different customs, different languages. And it's good that people can have true self-determination. And you can't have true self-determination is if Brussels is running everything or Washington. You need to have your self-determination in your local area. Ideally, where, you know, the whole nation you can get to within one day of drive. It should be like that size. So that's definitely what I advocate, smaller nations.
Yeah, I heard at Ameren there were two Puerto Rican nationalists, and they were advocating, they're in favor of breaking off and having Puerto Rico become independent from the United States.
Yeah, I met those guys, nice guys, and I support that too. I think Puerto Rico should be independent. Hell, I think Hawaii should be independent, and I think the United States should break apart. Probably the Southwest will become part of Otsland or whatever they call that, Hispanic community. So, you know, and there's, I think, merit to that as we start to break apart. I know it sounds crazy now, but when I was younger, I would have told you're crazy if you'd ever thought the Soviet Union would break apart, but it broke apart pretty quick, so things can happen. Oh, they did. I mean, I was in college during the Soviet age, and I was told I was ignorant, and communism is scientific progression, and the way everything's going to go, and communism always is on the march, and we're just reactionaries trying to hold on to an old system that's dated. And that's why when Reagan invaded Grenada, even though it was a tiny island, it had a huge psychological impact, because that was like one of the first time the country was communist and then ceased to be communist. And so it was kind of rolling it back, and it showed it wasn't invincible, which it wasn't. It was all based on a lie, basically. But then it fell apart because it was just all brittle. And I think the United States is a very brittle country at this point.
How long do you think it will take? Do you think it could break up fairly soon, or it could end up taking like 50 to 100 years?
It could, yeah. You know, one of those things, timelines are the hardest things because – you know, I would have never, if I was a gambling man, I would have never thought that the Soviet Union would break apart so quick. I really wouldn't, and it just did. Sometimes things happen. There's a black swan event, meaning something you don't even forecast, and things just spin out of control. I think the United States is that way now, too. It's very brittle, and there could be some event that all of a sudden just shakes everything up beyond what you'd imagine. Who knows? Maybe riots start to get out of control, and people white people want to have their own nation, or who knows? There's, things can happen, and they can happen quickly. I can't predict timelines because it's hard to say. There's so many variables.
And you see this all over the world. I mean, borders change all the time.
They do, and they cause a lot of issues, you know, if they're not representative of the people. I was in Romania, and there's still a very, very touchy subject of Transylvania should be part of Romania, because traditionally Transylvania was part of Hungary. In World War II, Romania, they started out on the German side, and then in 1944 they changed sides. I don't know if you could change sides in the middle of the war, but they did, and they fought for the Allies and the Russians. And then Stalin, as a gift to Romania, gave Transylvania to Romania, even though Transylvanians are ethnically Hungarian. So even to this day, there's a lot of bitterness within Romania and Hungary between the two peoples, because the Transylvanian people don't have self-determination. And they're both white people, right? But that's an example of why you need to consider diversity. It should be like, well, it's great now, because like, they're diverse. They have Hungarians in there, but it didn't work out that way. It just creates tensions to this day.
Yeah, I think Americans, they just, I mean, that's an American concept. They just see white people and then black people, and that's sort of an American outlook.
Yeah.
But in Europe, I mean, even like Hungarian nationalists despise Romanian nationalists, and then you have the thing, the Croats and the Serbs.
Oh, and they all hate the Russians with a passion because of the history, right? And
the English and the Irish.
Yeah, well, it depends. I mean, yeah, you know, I was talking to a girl over there, true story, about, you know, she's like, well, what is a white nationalist, or what's whites? And she goes, am I? Because she's from Eastern Europe. And I go, yeah, you're white. And she goes, yeah. And I said, like English? She goes, oh, yeah, Germans, yeah, I like them. And I said, I'm like Russians, and then I'm like Poles. And she goes, wait a minute, what did you say, Russians? And I'm like, yeah, Russians? What do you mean? They're worse. she's just like adamant that they're like I think she called them like the Jews of the white people. So there's a lot of animosity there between these various nations still, and we don't understand that in America, right? All look white to us, but there's differences there that is still pretty evident.
Yeah, I mean, same with Africa.
But it's just not white people, too. In Africa, the same way, right? We look at Africans all look the same to us, but in Africa there's various tribes that hate each other. In fact, in South Africa there's a bunch of race riots between different African tribes.
What's happening in South Africa is Africans from other parts of Africa, like Somalia, are immigrating to South Africa, and that's causing riots.
Yeah, so it goes to show they don't see Somalis as themselves, even though they're both black. They see them as quite a bit different, and they hate them. And so that's a common trait. That's why ethnic nationalism, that's why I'm not really a white nationalist, because I think nationalism is more than race, right? So, I don't think we should try to fit all white people into one. I'm a nationalist for all people, really. So I think all people have a right to their homeland and self-determination, and it makes things a lot happier and peaceful and so forth. It seems like a logical solution to me, right? Like this whole Ferguson thing and all these black problems. I'm like, hey, you had your own problem, your own country. You want to have white police officers and white whatever, and you seem not to like us. Fine, have your own country. And then, I mean, I don't think we'd object too much. But obviously they don't want that for reasons that they can't admit, so...
And yeah, I mean, from their perspective, I could see why they would resent having white police officers be dominant in their community, but they won't go out and say, like,
solution and they also, at least most of them know what an all-black country would look like, and they don't want to be a part of that. So, yeah, but they can't say that, right? But they know.
I think in Baltimore, the police department there is mostly black.
In where?
In Baltimore.
Belgium? Oh, Baltimore, yeah, it is. Most of these places are. Because of the, busing in the 60s, all the whites, they pretty much fled the cities. And because, you know, and whites, that's not an aggressive response, fleeing. But that just shows, I mean, if you allow people to behave naturally, they tend to go with their own. It just proves my point. Diversity is very unnatural. It can only be maintained through force. And if it wasn't for force, people naturally go among their own.
You had this post, why do white men commit suicide so frequently? This was in response to the German Wings pilot, but you actually show this chart on suicide rates in America.
Yeah, white men are one of the highest demographics. Besides, like, Native Americans, Indians, they're also very high. And I think it's more of because of a lot of us guys, we Europeans of our descent, I think it's because of evolutionary. We grew up in a rough, cold environment where winters came and so forth, and it required to be able to think ahead and plan ahead and so forth, which is a good trait. But it also keeps us in our minds a little bit. And so a lot of guys, I think, they get very depressed because they can't see a good future or hope. And so they kill themselves, whereas other races, they live more in the moment. And so, you know, they're happy now. They're not going to worry about what happens a year from now because they don't think that far in advance. They just think about having a good time now. So there's less suicides. At least that's my theory of why it happens more with white men.
And this chart shows Asians is very low, but I actually thought Japan had a very high, and Japan and South Korea, those two countries had high suicide rates.
I'm not really sure. Yeah, it's I think there's a lot of factors that go into it. But anyway, I think men also have the more because they have less support than women naturally do. People are naturally more sympathetic towards women than men. So that all goes into the equation, too.
And it also ties in with the whole scale.
Yeah. So, it's a sad situation, but I wish I'd tell those guys, you know, don't be like that. Just do something different. I mean, change your life. If you're not happy with your life, then what I call kill yourself metaphorically, meaning just do something totally different, move someone different, do something totally different in your life. I mean, what can it hurt, right? If you're at rock bottom, just do something totally different. So, and I think that gives people, because a lot of times things look really bleak, but then afterwards, years later, you look back on it and you're like, yeah, that's not that bad, you know? What was I thinking? And, you know, it's probably most people have been like that in relationships. You know, you go through a hard breakup, like, oh, I can't ever imagine life, you know, without her. Oh, how can I? And like a few years later, you're like, well, what was I thinking? You know? So it's one of those things that it's best not to act impulsively, but just do, you know, do something different if your current life is not working.
And you have this other video. It's Three Things for a Young Man to Know. And you got received a donation from a viewer named Brendan, and he asked you this question. And the three things that helped you are ignore the critics, be bold, and do what you love.
Yeah, and I think that's really important is to ignore the critics because so many people are just so worried about what people think of them. I always love this line from Ayn Rand. And again, I don't agree with all her philosophies, but I agree with what she said. Someone once asked her, what do you think about your critics? And she said, I don't. I don't think about them. And that's the way you have to be. Now, it's tougher. The only time, so people, like random people, say mean things about me all the time. I just really don't care. It doesn't bother me at all. I think it's funny. But so people have to get that way. Now, the only time a criticism that still means something to me is hard is when people are close to you give you criticism. And that can be tough, especially when it's your work, like my videos. And they're like, yeah, hey, you know, I wish you want to do this or do that. And it's tough because that's, you know, that's hard to resist that criticism because you care about the person. So that's the criticism part. Be bold, yeah. And that's part about being a guy. If you're going to be successful, you just got to be bold in whatever you do. Either be bold or do it or don't do it. Don't do it half-assed. Go all out if you're going to do it. And that's the way to get good at something and really everything in life. And doing what you love, I think everyone needs to do that. I think everyone has a passion in their life they need to follow. It can't be your job, at least do it on the side, because that's what makes life worth living. I can't tell people what their passion is, but always follow your passion.
Yes, and I guess that happiest people are the people whose jobs is their passion, but most people do have jobs they don't enjoy.
Yeah, that's true, but you never could tell what happens. My brother, he always had kind of crappy jobs, but then he always did his woodworking, and now he's very successful at it with his videos and stuff. He does it full-time, makes good money. So you never could tell. You know, people always do it on the side. I've met people that, you know, they work, but they love their singing, and you never know. You know? And even if you never make it, you know, a success financially, at least you're doing something you love and you get satisfaction out of it. Because I think that's what people are meant to do, is to, you know, do whatever your passion is that gives you a purpose in life, not just, you know, work in a cubicle 9 to 5, watch the ball game, and I guess wait till die. That's not a life. What kind of life is that? You know, you got to do what you, I suppose you're following your passion, right? You're doing these interviews, and see, that's cool. You take a chance. You're being bold. And if you do that, you probably get criticism, right? So you get all those three things you probably can relate to, right?
Speaking of criticism, I know it's like you Google Ramsey Paul, the first you see the article comes up from the SPLC, and then you see that Stormfront thread that says Ramsey Paul is a degenerate. You get those two things in contrast.
Yeah, that is kind of funny, and it's just an example of if you don't care about what your critics, you can do what you want. Everyone is like so scared of the SPLC. I mean, they're just like a slimy hate group that tries to defame people. I mean, to me, I think I told some young people, I'm like, you know, I'm so sorry, guys. I was just so busy doing work and other things. I never realized we got to the point in America where you're not allowed to speak your ideas. You know, I mean, not violent, just say your ideas. Somehow people, you know, that are trying to make that illegal and everything. I'm like, how did that ever become in America? It's like 100 times worse than McCarthyism we're at now. And so part of the reason I speak up is because, you know, my family, like we were just talking about, has been in this country before it was a country. And it's just a travesty what's happening. So, you know, I say to F them, I do what I want. So, you know, what else can they do at that point? And then Stormfront, when they, I just, you know, whatever they, I've learned, you know, if someone says something bad to me, I just embrace it. And then if you do that, it kind of leaves your critics to storm. It's a technique you see a lot with comedians do. Like if there's a comedian that's real fat, for example, the first thing, what's the first joke he's going to do? He's going to make a joke about his appearance, about being fat. Because, you know, everyone can see. So you just got to diffuse that right away. And then once you diffuse it, there's not, you know. So the thing with Stormfront calling me a degenerate, I'm like, God, yeah. I mean, you don't know half of it. I've done a lot of degenerate things in my life. That's for
sure.
I guess
they both have in common those two different, they would view themselves as they're enemies of each other. But they both take themselves really seriously.
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing I found is both groups, there's a lot of people, that's why I like to be independent, because there's a lot of people that like you, but if you just do this one thing different, you know, like you could be part of our club and we really like you, but your stance on this one issue, you just have this problematic with us. You need to change that. And it's so easy to compromise and give in because if you want to be liked by everyone or that group, whatever the group is. So it's kind of hard to be independent because, you know, people may not like you. I ran into that with Ant-Man, and Jared Taylor is great because he's never censored me or anything like that. And But it's like, wow, I'm doing something pretty different than their usual speakers. So it's a risk, but I'm not going to compromise.
Does Ameren have certain things like that are topics or views that are off limits that they would not allow from a speaker?
You know, I don't know, because Jared, you know, he's never said anything for me off limits at all. All that he asks is that, you know, I'd like you to speak and just give me what your topic's going to be about, and then give us your notes as early as possible or PowerPoint so we can get that ready. But he's never told me, like, no, you can't. Well, once I did a title, I forget what it was. It's just crazy. He goes, oh, you don't really want that title, do you, Ramsey Paul? I shouldn't look it up. I forget what I wrote, but it was really funny.
I remember a funny joke you said. This was in one of your videos. You said, you're going to a Japanese theme party. It's either karaoke or bukkake.
Yeah, exactly. Did I say that to Ameren? I hope I didn't say that to Ameren. Yeah.
No, not Ameren. But Gerald Taylor's lived in he speaks Japanese, so he might know what that means.
I bet he will. You know, Jared Taylor's not as, and I think he's a little sensitive about this, but Jared Taylor's a regular guy. He really is a nice guy. He's a real gentleman. He's not snobby or anything like that. In fact, I'm doing a podcast with him on Sunday. But
I just had him on the show.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's a good guy. He really is. And so, in fact, I admire him being able to break Ameren or do something different. You know what I mean? It'd be easier. Just do the same old speakers. And it's just not me, right? He's had Jack Donovan, who is a men's rights activist. He's also a homosexual, but he had him speak. He's had a Native American speak there. I mean, he breaks, you know, Jared Taylor in his own way, he really kind of breaks a lot of conventions, even within, I hate to use the word movement because I don't know what movement means, but within the movement, you know, he gets a lot of criticism because he's able to do things that are kind of outside the box. So he's really kind of innovative and a risk taker. I admire him, that about him.
And I think you've mentioned this, but there's more diversity among the Ameren attendees than among the protesters.
Oh, literally. That's not in, yeah. This since I've been in Ameren, there's been an African American female there. There's been Asian people there. There's been Hispanics there. There's been homosexuals. There's been a Native American. Of course, there's Jews there, and it's a women, all sorts of crazy people like that, women even. So, yeah, it's a group, and it's become a lot more younger now, too. It's growing every year. Every year I go there, it gets more and more people there. And this year, a lot of young people, a lot more than ever before. So that's a nice sign to see, too.
I think what's happening is that it's reaching out to more just, regular people as opposed to, like, mm-hmm. movement people.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I like about Ameren. They're pro-white without all the, movement garbage, you know, the whole, you know, I won't even go into it all, you know, the garbage, right? The stuff that turns normal people off. Most normal people, they don't want to go somewhere where there's things decal and racial holy war and all that crap. Normal people don't want that. And so that's not allowed at Ameren. So you're saying what's allowed? I don't know. They do have a dress code there, and so that's a good way to prevent kooks. And it's so funny because the SPLC, they always send their spy. They send a spy to see what's going on. Like we're some secret Klan meeting. It's so ridiculous. It's open to the public, and all the videos we post on YouTube. So, I mean, why do you have a spy? I think I made a joke about it. It'd be like them sending a spy to the Denver Broncos game. You know, televised. Like, he's a spy. It's, geez, come on. Talk about going full retard, but that's, you know, I'm like, well, what a brave spy into a public event. But anyway, if you ever go to Ameren or any of your listeners, and I hope you go, Robert, I'll buy you a beer. It's really, there's none of that. I've never heard like the N-word said, even in private. And people don't even really talk about race. They just get together, drink, have fun. And you've seen all the videos, Rob. You can see what the talk's about, all sort of different subjects. So it's not what the SPLC tries to make it, that's for sure.
So, you obviously, one of your latest videos, it's called Dickonomics Response.
Yeah, that was at Tinder, which I never used, obviously, but I mean, she was just talking about kind of a bitter girl about how, I think she said dick is abundant and low value or whatever. which is true, but she kind of missed the point.
You see her picture. I mean, she looks like really like broken, like almost like a cracko.
Yeah, you know, I don't make fun of people's appearance because I'm not Johnny Depp, right? Okay, I'm not the most handsome guy, but sometimes it's really shocking. I think it's really sad because I think she was probably really, really cute probably about 10 years ago. I really do. So it's kind of sad when they live a hard life and at 30, they already look aged. But that's what can happen when you live a lifestyle like that where you're promiscuous. And usually people are promiscuous, they mix up with drugs, drinking. I'm not sure if she has, but, you know, not saying her, but that's common with that kind of grouping because most women really aren't into that lifestyle. So the ones that are usually they get the idea, why am I giving this away for free when I can charge? So you kind of go down that road then. But, yeah, so...
What was the point you were making? What was your response to her?
Well, my response to her is, yeah, for a woman to get dick, as she called it, meaning sex, it's abundant and easy, which no doubt, right? And there's evolutionary differences between men and women. That's why we're sexually different because, women, they can only have one baby a year, so they have to be more selective. And this is something they don't always think through, but they just kind of know instinctually they got to try to make the best investment they can. And men, we're not under that constraint. So that's why men tend to be more, are up to having sex more than women with random people. So that's the reason. But for a woman, the hard thing is not to get sex, because almost any woman, unless you're horribly fat or disfigured, can get sex. That's just easy for a woman. But what's hard for a woman is to get a man that will, stick with her, provide for her, a man that's kind of higher status that she can be proud of. So it's not really the dick, but the man that is attached to the dick that can be high value and kind of rare, not abundant. So she kind of missed the point.
She's complaining she can't get that.
Can't get what? The high value.
She's complaining she can't get, yeah.
Yeah, well, duh, because what high-value man would want a woman that has an ounce to the world she sleeps around that much? Because I think there's been studies done that the more women sleep around, the less they're able to bond to any one man. So if any man did marry her, I doubt the marriage would last, right? So I think men kind of instinctively know that. So they're kind of, that's why men and women, you ask them a question, how many sexual partners have you had in your life? Men almost always will lie upwards and, exaggerate how many. And women lie the other way. They say way low than what the real number is because they just kind of instinctually know, kind of as a guy, it's kind of a good thing. It shows that, you're high value because you get these girls. But as a girl, if you have a high number, it means you're promiscuous and you're less desirable. So. And again, those are biological reasons for that. They're not because of social constructs or anything like that. It's because, to be honest, an egg takes a year to fertilize, and sperm is cheap, right? We make some every day.
Well, it should be just basic. The thing is, it's basic biology, but a lot of people who are supposedly well-educated don't get just basic biology. Even if they're not,
it's mostly the culture of Marxists. This is part of their theme of equality, where everyone's exactly all, races are exactly the same except for, skin color. And all between men and women, there's no difference between a man and a woman besides, the sexual organs. Otherwise, we're exactly the same. And the only differences are because of social conditioning or whatever. And that's why they try to push that in their Hollywood movies. My favorite is you have a 110-pound little girl that kicks ass, all these guys trying to beat her up, and she's just like badass. And because they're trying to show that women, even little women, can be as strong as a man. It's like, no, not in reality. What are you talking about? It's just total fiction. But they try to push that fiction. So they try to push it sexually too, that women and men are exactly the same sexually. And no, if women try to act like men sexually, they're really damaged. And that's the trouble with feminism. Feminism hates femininity. They hate women. They want women to try to be ape-like men, try to be imitations of men, which really ends badly because women aren't men. And when they try to act like men, it comes off poorly and it harms them.
We are out of time, but Ramsey Paul,
okay.
It's been a great show.
Yeah, let me know when you post it, and I'll post it, okay?
Okay, thanks again. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back next time.
All right. Bye-bye.